From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump is traveling today to Calexico, California. He'll see sections of a wall that's under renovation at the border. And as he left the White House this morning, the president claimed he was not backing down on his threat to shut down the border after saying yesterday that he's giving Mexico 1 year to stop illegal immigration and drugs.
I never changed my mind at all. I may shut it down at some point, but I'd rather do tariffs. So Mexico, I have to say, has been very, very good. You know that over the last 4 days since I talked about shutting down the border.
This week, Trump also claimed he wasn't backing down on a repeal of the Affordable Care Act, even though he said he won't try and repeal it for the rest of his current term as president. Our Friday roundtable joins us, ABC News political director Rick Klein. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
And Univision News anchor Enrique Acevedo. Hi, Enrique.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
So let's start with the border. After saying last week in no uncertain terms on Twitter that he would shut down the U.S. border with Mexico this week unless Mexico stopped all illegal immigration coming into the U.S., the president now says he's giving Mexico a year and that he'll punish Mexico with tariffs first if there's no action in a year. Here he is.
The only thing, frankly, better but less drastic than closing the border is to tariff the cars coming in. And I will do it, just like you know I will do it. I don't play games. I'll do it.
Rick, why does he do this? Does he not worry about his credibility when he makes threats and then doesn't carry through on them?
It's a complete reversal, but it's also almost totally unexpected. I'll tell you, when he started issuing these threats late last week, I was talking to Republicans on Capitol Hill who thought he wasn't serious about it. They immediately said, well, let's see if he actually does it or not. I think there's a sense that it's really just bluster, maybe a part of negotiating, and that he was always going to reverse course. His administration knew that this would have been an economic disaster. He was being told by Democrats and Republicans alike that this isn't the way to do business. The Mexicans clearly signaled that they weren't going to change their behavior. The president is wrong if he thinks that there was some massive change in the way that the Mexican government is handling this. It's how he does business, for better or for worse. And at this point, it's almost not even unexpected.
Well, Enrique, the president of Mexico, the new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has actually, I think, been very been kind of nice to Trump this week about all of this. He hasn't, you know, lashed back out at President Trump. How does Mexico take all of this when President Trump says he's going to do something like that and then doesn't do it and then says he's going to do it in a year?
Well, he has been extra nice, López Obrador, to Trump. And I don't know about diplomatic channels, any talks that are not being made public. But from what we know, the government, the new government of Mexico, has played along with Trump's anti-immigrant policies. And that's what the point Rick was making is such an important one, because Mexico didn't really change anything in the last 4 days, as the president says. They've been apprehending Central Americans at the same rate probably for the last 10, 15 years, which is something that most of the people in Mexico don't really approve. But it only started to become evident lately with Trump in power here in the U.S. So I kind of get the feeling that we're going to see more of this as the campaign gets closer. And regardless of the facts, this is going to be the narrative from the White House.
But Enrique, didn't Mexicans hope that López Obrador would be a foil to President Trump when they elected him?
Well, he said it himself. Before the election, he spent time here in the U.S. with Mexican immigrants. He promised he was going to be a counterpower to Donald Trump and his anti-Mexican, not only anti-immigrant, I would say anti-Mexican narrative. But now in power, it's been a different story. And people are in certain ways disappointed about it.
Rick, meanwhile, there was another flip, which was on the issue of health care. The president, the Justice Department came out and said that it was going to side with a court case that wanted to repeal all of Obamacare. Then the president said he wanted to repeal Obamacare. Then Republicans sort of weren't very happy about that. And then he came out and said, actually, we're not going to do this until after the election. Do you think anything is going to happen on health care between now and the election, or is it going to be another big issue in the election in 2020?
the Republicans are going to have to be offering something if the president is going to be serious about putting it on the ballot. It's not a serious proposal to say, I'll tell you about the plan after the election if we hold the House and if I win re-election. That's just not how it works. And you're going to hear a lot about health care, frankly, from the Democrats. We're having a robust policy debate right now over what health care should look like in this country. Medicare for all. Do you want that? Do you want a public option, single payer? Those things are playing out. And there's no way that Republicans can truly be successful in 2020 by sitting it out, by having a secret plan that you only learn about later.
To that point, Rick, Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, told the Washington Post that she's agnostic about this idea of Medicare for all. It's very popular with the 2020 Democratic presidential hopefuls. What's the power of that? Does it slow the momentum for those candidates who are pushing that ambitious policy goal, which is very controversial in many people's minds?
I think it's the most realistic stance to have, is to say it's going to get played out during the presidential primary process. And if there is a new Democratic president and a Democratic House and maybe a Democratic Senate, let's have the debate. I don't think Pelosi really advances the conversation by offering a bill that has no prayer of becoming law under President Trump anyway. Democrats are they're conflicted on this. They're having this big debate, and it's very possible that you're going to have a primary about health care and then a general election about health care as well.
Enrique, let's talk about the Mueller report and the Barr letter. We're still waiting for the full Mueller report. We'll see if that actually comes this month to Congress. But in the meantime, is Special Counsel Robert Mueller going to have to testify before Congress about what was in his report after some members of his team reportedly said this week that they feel that Barr understated what they had put in there about obstruction of justice?
I have a very suspicious mind, Jeremy, and I think this was part of the intent with the results of the Mueller report or what we know about it so far. I think Mueller wanted Congress to take the role of being this counterbalance, this counterpower to the executive, and he didn't want to make any decisions on matters like obstruction of justice because in a way he thought that was a job of Congress and they were letting him do the hard part and putting all the expectations on that investigation. So we might see Robert Mueller in Congress soon and testifying. Hopefully, you know, we'll know more about his report, and transparency will be the rule here.
Democrats want to hear from Mueller, but they also want the president's tax returns. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi yesterday.
Let's rise to a level of presidential in all of this. Show us the Mueller report. Show us the tax returns. And we're not walking away just because you say no the first time around.
And so there was an effort this week to get those tax returns. We'll see if the IRS complies. The president has promised to fight it. But Republicans, Rick, have been warning Democrats about the political price of these investigations. What's the strategy now for Democrats? Is it smart for them to say, keep fighting for those tax returns?
Look, I think they're split on it, and I think the effort is unlikely to bear fruit anytime soon. It's almost entirely likely, probably certain, that there's no tax returns that are going to be seen, I would say, before the 2020 election.
You think the president will be able to stop it?
I think the president, I think the White House and the administration will say no. They'll say it's politically motivated, and it ends up in the courts. And you can't imagine something like this. This is a huge precedent-setting thing. It goes all the way to the Supreme Court in all likelihood, and we're more than a year away from even having those legal debates. So I think, look, Congress has on its side the authority to ask for tax returns. They haven't done it in this kind of form or fashion. Asking for a president's tax returns is hardly a political. There are public interest reasons for doing it, but we're in uncharted territory. They haven't had to ask for previous presidents because going back since Nixon, all presidents have just
given them up,
turned over to the public those tax returns. And the president himself has said he would, notwithstanding his refusals now.
Okay. In the last couple of minutes we have, let's talk about 2020. This morning, former Vice President Joe Biden held his first public appearance after several women came forward to say he touched them in public in ways that made them feel uncomfortable. Enrique, he was kind of joking about it today, saying that people had given him permission to hug them at this event that he was at. But zoom out a little bit. It looks like he's preparing to run for president despite all of this.
Definitely. And the answer is, has the apology been enough? And that's something that women are going to have to answer in 2020 if he decides to go ahead and run and he wins the candidacy. So that's, I don't think you're going to get a monolithic answer. Some are going to say, yes, that was enough. Some are going to say no. I mean, 42% of women voted for Trump, despite everything we knew about him before the election. So we'll see.
Rick, as you look at all of the candidates right now that are running in 2020, it seems like one thing that is standing out for people is the level of energy that many of them have. You see Beto O'Rourke standing up on tables. You see Elizabeth Warren running to the train station on camera. I mean, President Trump, if nothing else, is a very energetic person. You can tell when you see him and when you see how often he's tweeting and how often he's talking about things. How much does energy matter, do you think?
Well, you didn't even mention Mayor Pete, the man who won the quarter based on that youthful energy, sleeves rolled up, ready to show the mayoral ambitions can be presidential. I think people want to see an active candidate. They want to see an active president. And Joe Biden's an energetic guy himself. Mm-hmm. It is interesting because I think the optics around this does matter. And Bernie Sanders had an accident with a shower door recently and appeared with a bandage that kind of changed perceptions of him. When you have this range of candidates all the way from age 37 through 77, you're going to have a huge range of human activity and emotions and everything else. And I think it is there's a physical aspect to this primary that maybe we haven't focused on yet.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, Enrique, we have a new name this week as well, 45-year-old Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan. What do you think about that? This field's getting ever more crowded.
I've lost count, to be honest. It is a crowded
field. 250.
It feels like that, but I guess Democrats think it's within their reach. They think they can win it, and that's part of why we're seeing so much interest.
That is Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision, Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Neither of them running yet for candidate for president in 2020. Thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Lawmakers advanced a bill in the Senate this week that would put heavy fines on the people responsible for calls like this.
Once you get this message, kindly call us back as soon as possible on our number before we begin with the legal proceedings against you.
The TRACED Act would allow the federal government to fine robocallers up to $10,000 per call, and it would give regulators more time, up to 3 years, to bring charges. Ian Barlow is helping fight this war against robocalls. He runs the Do Not Call program for the Federal Trade Commission. Ian, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Good to have you. And by some estimates, 26 billion robocalls were made to U.S. cell phones last year. How big has this problem gotten?
Well, it's a huge consumer issue. It's the top consumer complaint we get at the FTC. We get about 400,000 to 500,000 complaints every month about unwanted calls. That's a really significant number. It's by far and away our top complaint, and we take it very seriously.
So that robocall that we heard at the top was a message that I actually got on my voicemail a few weeks ago, and I want to play one more that I've also been getting recently.
This call is from the Department of Social Security Administration. The reason you have received this phone call from our department is to inform you that we just suspend your social security number because we found some suspicious activity. So if you want to know about this case, just press 1. Thank you.
So I actually did press 1, and the first thing that the person on the other end asked me for was my social security number. I said no, and he hung up. But it left me wondering, and maybe you can shed some light on this, who is making these phone calls?
A lot of these are scammers who are overseas. And in a lot of instances, they don't have any aspect of their operation really that touches the United States. In many instances, they take their payment through iTunes gift cards or Google Play cards or Amazon cards over the phone. And they don't have any physical presence in the United States. Now, there are lots of other scams where the FTC brings cases and we sue people where we do find a U.S. actor. But in this particular instance, they're often overseas.
When I tried to call back the number that was listed, it didn't work, and it was just a couple of days later. I mean, are they moving really quickly through these phone numbers, or is somebody actively shutting them down?
I think the most likely thing is that that phone number that was displayed in the caller ID was spoofed, meaning they didn't have permission to use that number. It wasn't an actual working phone number at any time.
So there's this bill in the Senate that's moving through. It's called the TRACED Act. I assume it's going to deal with some of these issues. Do you think it'll make a difference?
The TRACED Act does have some language in it that we're hopeful could make an impact. And that's really the part about the what's called stir shaken and the verification of caller ID numbers to prevent exactly what happened to you.
That spoofing.
With that spoof. Right. So stir shaken is a protocol for the telecom carriers to verify that the caller ID number displayed is being used by somebody who actually has permission to use that number. Once that happens, theoretically, the calls will show up as either verified, unverified, or information not available. And the telecom carriers have discussed using like a red flag, a yellow flag, and a green flag with those symbols. And if the telecom carriers implement that, we think that can help a lot in restoring trust in caller ID and letting consumers know which calls to answer, which calls to ignore or reject.
Well, in fact, if you are a customer of T-Mobile, I just saw this today. A warning will come up on the screen of your cell phone that says scam likely. So in some ways, it sounds like this is already happening. But probably a lot of people out there are feeling like, does it even matter if my name is on this do not call list, for instance? Because people are still getting a lot of robocalls.
Right. People are still getting calls, but we think the do not call list still works for the job it was intended to do. There's two things it does. First, for compliant telemarketers, those that do follow the law, it tells them not to call you if you're on the do not call list. And there is a fair large subsection of the telemarketing industry that does comply. Now, for the non-compliant telemarketers who call you anyway, it lets you know immediately they're breaking the law. That's not somebody you want to speak with, so you should just hang up right away.
Do you think this war is winnable, this robocall war?
Well, look, like any law enforcement challenge, we're going to keep doing our job. We're going to keep enforcing the law and protecting consumers. We think we can make an impact here and reduce the volume of unwanted calls. We think it requires a three-part approach: strong law enforcement. The FTC is first and foremost a law enforcement agency. Second, we work with industry to promote technological solutions. We've held several challenges where we offer cash prizes to companies to innovate and develop new call blocking tools. When we started doing that, there were very few call blocking apps on the market. Today, there are hundreds. And then the third thing is we believe in strong consumer education. We want to get our message out to consumers. Register for Do Not Call, hang up on unwanted or illegal calls, report illegal or unwanted calls at donotcall.gov, and consider a call blocking solution. And we think with that combination, we can make an impact and reduce the volume of unwanted and illegal calls.
Ian Barlow oversees the Do Not Call program for the Federal Trade Commission. Ian, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your interest in our program.
Peter, I, for one, hope that we win the war on robocalls because they drive me crazy, as I'm sure they drive everybody crazy. Well, Indian officials declined to comment this week after NASA criticized India for shooting down one of its own low-orbit satellites and creating space debris that could threaten the International Space Station. India shot down the satellite last month to test a missile. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports the incident has brought the issue of space debris back into the spotlight.
India's test of its anti-satellite missile was met with criticism from NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine, who said over the subsequent 10 days it increased the risk of collision with the International Space Station by 44%.
And that kind of activity is not compatible with the future of human spaceflight.
It's the first time an anti-satellite weapon's been used since China blew up an aging weather satellite in 2007, which drew worldwide protest over the estimated 2 million piece debris field it caused. An estimated 500,000 objects orbit Earth, from school bus-sized weather satellites to marble-sized paint flecks, traveling 7 times as fast as a bullet. Despite this seemingly large number of objects, odds are low that any two of them will collide.
There's another story we're following right now. I want to bring in Brian Todd. It involves satellites actually colliding in space with debris fragments.
But it does happen, as this 2009 collision between an Iridium satellite and a defunct Russian satellite proves. Last year, the world had 25% more launches than 4 years prior, and those launches left about 76% more stuff in orbit, according to spacetrack.org, which is maintained by the U.S. Air Force. As more and more countries and companies launch satellites, many scientists and governments are hoping to come up with a plan, norms of behavior, and technology to ensure that space remains sustainable. One approach: remove the riskiest objects.
Unfortunately, it's a bit of a thing of human nature that whenever we go that is unspoiled, we leave behind a lot of rubbish.
Professor Guglielmo Aglietti is director of the Surrey Space Center in the UK. His removed debris satellite is in space now trying to prove an active debris abatement program can work. So far, they've caught 2 mock satellites with a harpoon and a net. The demonstration cost about $17 million, but proved if someone wants to pay for it, they can make it work.
This is something that is a commons. It's something that needs to be taken care of by everyone.
Mike Safian is vice president of launch at Planet Labs, which owns and operates one of the largest fleets of satellites in the world. The company came out against India's anti-satellite test.
We don't want to be in the scenario where we start seeing more and more collisions, which create more debris, which create more risk for future collisions, this kind of runaway domino effect.
Companies like Planet don't put new satellites up without a plan to bring them down. They also communicate directly with contemporaries about satellite locations. But Safian says they need better data from more places, which is why they've partnered with University of Texas Austin professor Mariba Jha. Sitting in his office, Jha calls up Astriograph on his computer monitor. On the monitor, a 3D representation of the Earth sits awash in more than 26,000 objects. Those are just the ones that are big enough to track, or about the size of a softball.
Let's just go with one of Planet's Flock 1C10.
When he types in the name of one satellite, four different sources pinpoint four different locations.
I'm just going to pause this real quick, and I'm just going to zoom in. And those aren't very close, are they? I mean, that's a sizable portion of the United States.
More than 1,000 miles separates the point where the Defense Department says the satellite is from where the company knows it is. What Jha thinks his website does is reduce risk for operators and demonstrate that a civil space traffic management system is achievable and necessary. The DoD and FAA are slowly working towards this. Europe is also. In the meantime, Astriograph can show what's really going on up there and at some point show what impact bad actors are having.
So what I want to do is I want to lay out the science that can serve as an EPA equivalent for space and, again, for safety, security, and sustainability.
The timing couldn't be better, says Jha, who points to the November approval of SpaceX launching 7,000 Cube satellites over the next few years. For Here and Now, I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
College basketball's big weekend is upon us. Tomorrow, the men's Final Four in Minneapolis features two newcomers and two veteran teams. But tonight in Tampa, Florida, it's the women's Final Four, Baylor, Oregon, Notre Dame, and Connecticut. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman is here to break it down for us. Hi, Tom.
How are you, Jeremy?
I'm doing well. And let's start with the overall number one seed, Baylor, against Final Four first-timer Oregon.
Baylor has last lost a game December 15th of last year. They have won 27 in a row. And their head coach, Kim Mulkey, still is trying to convince people that Baylor isn't the favorite. Jeremy, they're the favorite. Number one in the nation in block shots, rebounding, and on offense, the nation's fourth best field goal percentage, meaning the Bears convert a good number of shots they take. They have two dominating low post players, 6'7" Kalani Brown, 6'4" Lauren Cox. Very hard to get to the basket with those two in the key. And Oregon may not even try. The Ducks shoot a lot of three-point shots. They shoot from all over the court. They have a very versatile offense led by Player of the Year, Sabrina Ionescu. She's a fantastic playmaker. Another top player is Satu Sabali, a 6'4 guard forward. But as good as they are, it's a huge challenge for Oregon.
And by the way, that is coming from an Oregon alum, Tom Goldman. So there you go. You
trying to be objective.
Exactly. Okay. Let's talk about the other game. This is Notre Dame versus Connecticut. This is really one of the great rivalries in women's basketball.
It is. This is the 50th time they will play, including their eighth meeting in the Final Four. Notre Dame has a couple of great guards to keep an eye on, Arike Ogunbowale and Jackie Young. Ogunbowale, you may remember, shot down UConn last year with a last-second shot in the national semifinals. UConn doesn't have the transcendent stars that it's had in the past, but it has Katie Lou Samuelson and Nafisa Collier, and after an uncharacteristically down year, meaning the Huskies lost twice, gasp. They're playing well, and they seem to be peaking at the right time.
Why is UConn not a number one seed for this tournament, as they have been, I feel like, for my entire life?
Well, since 2006, they've been a number one seed every year since then. They're not as great defensively or rebounding. In early February, Gino Auriemma, the head coach, said in his inimitable fashion, "We kind of suck this year." You know, they've used the no number one seed as motivation. They're in their 12th straight Final Four. That's a record for both women and men. And they still do have this sense of royalty with 11 national titles. They haven't won since 2016, and they seem determined not to flame out in the semifinals for a third straight season.
And there's a rivalry between the coaches of Notre Dame and UConn too, right?
Oh, big time. Yeah. Muffet McGraw and Gino Auriemma. There's a new chapter in that as well. Recently, McGraw, the Notre Dame head coach, she's been speaking out against the increasing numbers of male coaches in women's basketball, while the reverse, women coaches in men's basketball, is practically nil. McGraw says that's wrong, that women should lead women. And she's had an all-female staff since 2012 and says she doesn't intend to hire any men going forward. Now, Auriemma responded by saying, "I hope she sends a thank you to all those guys that used to be on her staff that got her all those good players that won a championship." So if the rivalry wasn't spicy enough, this adds to today's game.
That is NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman talking to us about the Women's Division I College Basketball Tournament, which wraps up this weekend in Tampa, Florida. Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome.
Former Vice President Joe Biden was in a joking mood today, saying to a crowd that various people at a public event gave him permission to hug or touch them. A number of women have come out publicly to say they felt uncomfortable because of the way he touched them in the past, though they're not claiming sexual harassment or assault. It started with former Nevada State Assemblywoman Lucy Flores, who spoke on NPR, among other places, about her experience with Biden at a campaign rally in 2014.
Eva Longoria was in front of me. Joe Biden was behind me. And, you know, I just all of a sudden feel his hands and I feel him get up really close to me. And I'm just, you know, at that point processing and I'm thinking, okay, this is really weird. But then he leans in and then he like inhales and then he proceeds to plant this long kiss on the top of my head. And the entire time I'm just kind of like, what is happening?
We're going to take the politics out of this for a moment and look at these allegations in the context of the Me Too movement. Joining us now is Terry O'Neill, who's executive director of the National Employment Lawyers Association and former president of the National Organization for Women. Welcome to Here and Now. And obviously, this is a very different allegation than so many others in the Me Too movement. But do you think this is part of the Me Too movement?
First, yes, there's a very big difference. And second, yes, this is part of the Me Too movement. I think this is an incredibly important conversation for us to have nationally. I actually come at this from the perspective of employment law and from the perspective of really truly eradicating discrimination from the workplace. And clearly, that kind of behavior in the workplace is unacceptable.
But do you think at all that it sort of dilutes the Me Too movement when you have allegations like this, which are in a very different category than, let's say, Harvey Weinstein?
You know, I don't think it dilutes it. I think what's important about the Me Too movement is that it has lifted up not only that there are predators who are known to be predators in some workplaces who are protected by people in power, and that's a bad thing. That's the Harvey Weinstein, that's the Charlie Rose and those kinds of behaviors. But the Me Too movement is powerful and broad precisely because it goes beyond that. And it actually forces us to have a conversation about why is it that women are subjected to this kind of behavior? Well, one reason that that happens is because of stereotyped thinking about who gets to have sexual access to women. Predators like Harvey Weinstein thinks that he should have sexual access to women, that they don't have any right to say no or to have any control over their bodies. That's a predator. But then there's the people who on the basis of these stereotypes, engage in jokes. And the reason we laugh at them as a society is precisely because the stereotype exists. Like, for instance, a remark that a father needs to be very, very protective against this handsome guy for, on behalf of his daughter. Well, the stereotype behind that joke, lighthearted remark, is that fathers have sexual control over their daughters until they become adults, at which point husbands have sexual control over their wives. I mean, that's truly what's behind this. And the Me Too movement has surfaced some of these conversations. And I think it's very healthy for us, our society, to begin dealing with those kinds of issues.
But you wouldn't call Joe Biden in this case a predator, I don't think. And you probably
not even close.
Not even close. And he's not making a joke at the expense of women. So what category does what he's doing fall into, do you think?
It falls into this category. It falls into a category of behaviors that he did not intend to be offensive, which the person receiving the behavior was offended by. So you have a situation where someone who acts or speaks does not intend to be offensive, but the person receiving it is offended. And I think as a society, we need to hold both of those truths as truths. And that the more powerful person, and let's be clear, in America, white male equals privilege. And so the more powerful, more privileged people need to step back for a moment and reflect that what I send is not necessarily what you receive.
Well, here is what Joe Biden said in the video in response to not just Lucy Flores' allegation, but others as well.
You know, social norms have begun to change. They've shifted. And the boundaries of protecting personal space have been reset. And I get it. I get it. I hear what they're saying. I understand it. And I'll be much more mindful. That's my responsibility. My responsibility, and I'll meet it. But I'll always believe governing, quite frankly, life for that matter, is about connecting with people. That won't change, but I will be more mindful and respectful of people's personal space.
How difficult do you think it is for a white male in this country to be more mindful when, as you say, one of the reasons that these things become a big deal is because one side sees it one way and one side sees it another way?
The way it has to be done is the more powerful person has to listen and practice deep listening. Good for Joe Biden, by the way, for committing to be more mindful. Mindful is good. Deep listening is equally important, and he has to commit to deep listening. I'm an upper middle class, white, cisgendered, heterosexual woman. I need to remind myself constantly of the need for deep listening as well. So it's not just I've learned something and now I have it in my head that I've learned and now I'm going to behave accordingly. I think it's also I need to hear someone saying something that initially makes no sense to me. And I need to really try to understand why this person is, what she's saying makes sense to her but doesn't make sense to me. That's the deep listening that needs to happen. It's really hard for privileged people to get there. But I applaud a stated intention of Vice President Biden to try to get there. I think it has to be more than, yes, I've been informed. It's got to be more. I am going to be listening in an ongoing way because guess what? Not everybody responds the same way to the same behavior, right? Some women, it's just fine. Mm-hmm. Other women, it's offensive. It's uncomfortable. You can't just say, I'm going to be one way for everybody because that's what I want to be. You have to say, I will be in relationship, meaning actually listening to different people who have different responses to the way I behave.
Well, then in that case, do you think that it's appropriate for this story about what happened with Joe Biden to come out in such a public way when he's deciding whether to run for president and actually may be a reason that he doesn't run for president or may make his run more difficult just because of this incident and some others like it that people found uncomfortable and that he should have been more mindful of, you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think that these national conversations are painful. I think that painful consequences happen when we have these conversations. We avoid, and then poof, someone finally speaks out and it kind of blows up in everybody's faces. That's a shame. That doesn't mean that it's okay to not have the conversation.
Do you think we're going to start to see more of these kinds of allegations that are kind of in the Joe Biden category come out now that Lucy Flores and others have come out and talked about what happened with him?
You know, I think we might. And I think one of the reasons is because I'm going to again take this back to the workplace. One of the biggest problems with invading someone's boundary or invading their space is that it throws the person off and she can't do her job that she went to that workplace to do. It's extraordinarily difficult to win discrimination cases in court. That kind of behavior might not rise to the level that courts demand in order to have any kind of legal accountability. But in the workplace itself, it is absolutely not okay for some people to be thrown off of their ability to do a good job because they're being made uncomfortable. So that's why I say these conversations are extremely important. I think more and more awareness is being raised. So I think these conversations are going to continue to happen. And I don't think it's going to be limited to candidates for office.
And what do you think is the best way for people to respond when they've been accused of something like this?
I think the first thing they need to say, assuming that they didn't intend any offense, is to say, I'm sorry, I did not intend offense, and now I need to listen to you. And if you're willing to talk, I would like to listen.
That is Terry O'Neill, who is executive director of the National Employment Lawyers Association and former president of the National Organization for Women. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And here's a story you probably missed this week. A concrete overpass spanning Interstate 75 in Chattanooga, Tennessee, collapsed on Monday. Lieutenant Danny Jones of the Chattanooga Police Department said one person driving beneath the bridge was injured.
As one of the cars got here on scene, they located a blue vehicle that had ran into the fallen piece of the bridge. At that time, we went ahead and administered first aid to the driver, and then we had transported the driver to the hospital.
So why are we talking about this? Well, this week, the annual Deficient Bridge Report came out, and it wasn't good. According to the American Road and Transport Builders Association, 47,000 bridges in this country are in poor condition and in need of urgent repair, including some iconic bridges like the Brooklyn Bridge in New York. Allison Black is chief economist for the group. And Allison, 47,000 bridges out of 600,000 total in the U.S. What's wrong with them exactly?
Well, these are bridges where one of the key elements during the bridge inspection is rated in poor or worse condition. And usually that's either the deck or the superstructure above a bridge or the substructure underneath. And sometimes, you know, this isn't always visible to the traveling public, but they are in need of repair.
It doesn't mean necessarily that they're about to fall down, right?
That's right. What we saw in Tennessee this week was an extreme case, but these are bridges which, again, are in poor condition and they do need to be fixed. And in addition to those bridges that are structurally deficient, about 4 out of 10 bridges across the country need some sort of major rehabilitation work. So unfortunately, it's not just these 47,000 structures that need to be fixed.
Can you explain the type of work that it would take to fix these bridges? Your report estimates that it would take 80 years, which is more than double what you thought it would take the year before.
It takes double because the pace of repair has slowed significantly. So every year, bridges are fixed, and as they're inspected, they're removed from the structurally deficient category. So overall, this past year, we reduced that number by about 550 bridges. So if we continue at this slow pace, that's where it's going to take over 80 years to fix them. It was a few years ago, we were fixing these bridges at a much faster rate.
What's happened? Why has the pace slowed? I just wonder if it has something to do with the fact that it's hard to get a construction worker anywhere in this country right now.
I think part of it has to do with overall funding. We've seen a number of states pass initiatives to raise their gas taxes, which is certainly helping. And while we do have a federal aid bill There's not a lot of new money. It really is just keeping pace with project costs and inflation. So I think we're really looking to Congress to step up and provide some additional resources. And I think if we saw a significant increase in the federal funding side of this, that would really go a long way to help states that are trying to provide some of these repairs and fix these bridges.
Now, we'll get there because I know that's an important part of this conversation. But last week, the state of Mississippi shut down 34 of its bridges. And I want to listen to this from the state's transportation director, Melinda McGrath, explaining why.
Because imminent failure will occur. These bridges have been inspected by professional bridge inspection teams and deemed that they are dangerous to the public.
So in one way or another, we are all driving on these bridges across the country. Do you think that we can trust that other state governments are taking the necessary steps to keep people safe?
Yes, I think public safety is absolutely the number one concern of state DOTs and local governments. And what you're seeing in Mississippi is taking that responsibility to close those structures that are unsafe. The other steps that we see, which might be very common, is if you're driving over a bridge and you see that there are weight restrictions. But there's also a cost to that. There's an economic cost when freight shipments have to be rerouted. And we see that in many local communities.
Okay, I want to hear one more piece of tape. This is from President Trump's 2018 State of the Union address.
Tonight, I'm calling on Congress to produce a bill that generates at least $1.5 trillion for the new infrastructure investment that our country so desperately needs.
Over a year later, that still has not happened, although Democrats say they could work with the president on this. What would a dream infrastructure bill look like for you?
My version of a dream infrastructure bill, and I think where you would see the most return, is if we took the steps to shore up and fix the Highway Trust Fund, make sure that we have enough resources for states to use, and a significant increase in direct federal investment, which by law, most of that money is going directly to help with capital outlays and major projects like some of the bridge work that we're talking about. That would certainly drive significant growth and really give states the flexibility and the tools to make those needed investments.
Allison Black is chief economist for the American Road and Transportation Builders Association. Allison, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And one final note on this story. Last week, the Trump administration did float the idea of hiking the gas tax to fund infrastructure repairs. Congressional Democrats say, hey, we can work with that. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.